everybody out there in podcast land. This is Johnny Has the Keys. I'm Tim.
I'm David.
Hey, great to have you back, David. It's been a week.
Yep, great. It has.
How many ghosts have you seen?
I've seen quite a few. Actually, I'm not as bad as you and see the bent neck lady every day, but I do kind of look toward the corners now. Every scene I look at, every time I look around, I'm seeing something in the corners.
Yeah, so. Every time I walk by a dark cased opening, I feel like something standing in my periphery.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a heightened experience.
Yeah, most certainly. I guess it's creeping me out just as much the second time around as it did the first.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. What are you noticing anything seeing it a second time than the first? Is it scarier? Is it less scary? What do you think?
I think it's a little less scary because I'm not, anticipating a jump scare.
Mm-hmm.
But I am noticing things, and I'm taking more time to notice things in the background.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that statues move, so I'm looking for that now, and I wasn't really looking for that the first time around.
Yeah, yeah, I find myself doing the same thing. I agree with you. I don't think it's as scary the second time, but I do love the mood. I'm enjoying it more. I like the mood a lot more, basically because I'm not trying to, I think intellectually, I'm not trying to solve the puzzles. I'm trying to see how he tells the puzzles, maybe.
That makes
but
sense.
I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it a lot more. It's almost like a second read, I guess, of a novel. But I'm doing the same thing. I'm seeing a lot more technique. I'm seeing a lot more stuff in the background, so to speak, and the way he frames certain things to make it important. And when's he moving the camera? When's he not? You know, that kind of stuff. So, I'm enjoying it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, now that we know the answers to the big questions, it's easier to focus on the minutia of the story and then the details of the filmmaking.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, hoping that everybody listening to us knows that we're talking about The Haunting of Hill House, too.
Yeah, we just kind of jumped right in there. Whatever.
Just in case. But that's okay. Hopefully they've been following along.
Well, yeah. So. And I mean, some weeks we like to start with things that are interesting and fun that we've come across. But when we're doing one of these on a TV series where there's 10 episodes, it's not been that long since I talked to you.
Right. Right.
So we just kind of jump right back into it. So we're going to start off with episode 4 today. I'm going to try to guide us through this episode because David's been doing it quite a bit lately, and I thought I would take some of the brunt of that away from him. Episode 4 was entitled The Twin Thing. It is an episode that...
Great line.
Yeah, the episode that primarily focuses on the character of Luke, who is Nellie's twin, as we know. Luke, past and present. Any initial thoughts on the episode, David?
Well, again, it was one of those that I thought had a really good teaser. It has the scene basically where Luke's talking about nobody believes me, and it pulls back and we realize he's talking to Abigail. And I thought it was really creepy. It was really cool. It set it up really well. And then we got the credit scene. So I liked the teaser a lot.
Right. And it's really short.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a very brief opening with them on the grass in sort of a picnic thing going on, sitting on the grass. And him telling her that no one believes him. Then
and we never see her face and we never see her speak. So we're not, so we're still believing it's a ghost, believing that this is an imaginary friend that he has. Or a ghost that's, like Piggy in Amityville. That was kind of my key reminder in that one it's like an imaginary friend that we don't know. Is that a spirit or real or whatever?
Right.
And I really like this episode because it's Luke. I like that actor a lot. This actor's really good, and I like this character a lot. He's probably, I don't know, it's hard for me to say. We'll say at the end, but I think he's probably my favorite character in the show. And trivia-wise, I found out the actor who plays him has a very, very heavy British accent.
Oh.
And it's like a Cockney. It's like a Cockney British, too. When I saw an interview with him, I went, what? I mean, sounded totally different than Luke. It was very interesting.
Oh, I see. His name is Oliver. Please, sir, may I have some more?
Right. And that's basically, I mean, he has this kind of, it's a very thick, and he's talking like that, you know, and I'm going, really? That's Luke? Seriously?
Yeah, I would have never guessed. But then again, it's that way on The Walking Dead, too. There's so many Brits on that show, and I have no idea. I would have not known had I not known the behind-the-scenes stuff, that they were British.
Yeah. Very good accent work for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, we cut from them on the lawn to the credits, and then we are in the present day, or at least Luke grown up, and it is a rehab circle. With a veteran telling another ghost story. Actually, a form of a ghost story. A very creepy story, anyway.
Yeah, I totally got into that. I thought this was, again, he's telling a story. Story's telling the plot. And it's a horror story, but it's a different kind of horror. Totally. I really liked that.
We realize that this veteran is blind. And he tells a story about seeing a girl burned in the war. I can't remember what war it is. And how her eyes ran like runny eggs.
Yeah, yeah.
That line stuck with me.
That line stuck with me too. I was going to ask you about that, but yeah, me too. It was, and I think it was Iraq. I think the war he mentioned was like Desert Storm or Iraq or one of those, because it was more modern. Mm-hmm. But the first, and yeah, the runny eyes like eggs got me just because of the descriptive word of it. But the one that got me before that was like one of his first lines was something like, most people don't know what happens to eyeballs in a fire. And I thought, oh my gosh, that is a Tim Smith line if ever I've heard one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty nasty. And it's funny, I wrote a story ages ago that I don't even know where it is. It's in a drawer somewhere, called Flashback, that was about an acid flashback. And he talks about later on being on acid and not being able to stop seeing the little burnt girl with runny eyes. And so he takes some knitting needles and decides to blind himself. Mm.
Yes, I thought that was a very Stephen King horror story. It was it reminded me of a King type of thing that someone would do, a character that's so that is so scared or so frightened where they are that they actually, you know, maim themselves, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the thing that's truly horrific is that now that he's blind, he sees her all the time.
Yes, yeah, that's worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you have nothing to distract you now, so all you see is her.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was sad and horrible. And I like the fact that it was sad. I like the fact that it was horrific. It was startling, you know, but it was also, you felt such pity for him, so sad for him. And that's kind of the setup for the whole episode. These people are in these terrible situations that you just feel really, really sorry for them having to fight their own demons.
Right. Kind of thing. So we flash forward a bit. It's still present, or should I say grown Luke, but we are in a different room, and we are celebrating the fact that he is now 90 days clean. He gets his what do you call that, little token they give you?
Chip.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like the way that transitions, because this is like a verbal transition that kind of hooks us. It's, you know, like last week I commented that Flanagan was using these visual transitions to kind of hook us scene to scene. This one is more vocal because Luke says, you know, we can tell he's kind of stunned that he's lasted 90 days clean and everything. And he's trying to tell his story. And I guess this is the first time he's ever attempted to tell his story. And he kind of says it that way. He says, I've never been this way before. So I've never. And then he goes, so here goes. And then it cuts. So it was, I really like the fact that we're okay and we lean over and oh, now we're somewhere else.
So. And it would be to the next scene, which is Luke in the treehouse.
Yes.
I guess he's with his dad showing the monster from the basement drawing.
When he's in the treehouse, it's the first time we hear seven, because he's putting all the army men around the monster drawing, and he's counting each one, and then he puts seven out, like surrounding the monster. And then it cuts to him telling his dad.
Oh, that's right, because that's when Nell's hiding and they're pretending like they don't know where she is.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's very cute.
Again, a cute little parenting moment, but still, you know, still neat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is the first time we see the hat.
Yes.
The bowler hat. And they give it to him, don't they?
Yes. Well, Olivia brings it down because she talks about yard sale. We could have a yard sale with all this junk and blah, blah, blah. And she gives Nellie the box of buttons. And then Luke wants the hat, but Dad goes, no, it's too big for you. No, Mom. Olivia says, honey, it's too big for you. And Dad goes, I think he'll grow into it.
Right.
Because he uses it as that whole dad thing of, but you know, if you're going to wear a hat, you got to be a big boy. And big boys don't run around with monsters and all that. Or whatever he says. He says something like, you know, you got to grow it. You got to man up, basically, is what Dad's trying nicely to tell him.
Right. He's offering.
Because he doesn't believe him. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't believe him. And I think that's an echo throughout this whole, definitely this episode, but even later on, it becomes, I think, such a catalyst between Luke and the families. The fact that since I was a little kid, I kept saying stuff and you never believed me. Nobody ever believed me except Nellie. And I think that's his, I don't want to say it's like his Achilles heel, but I think it is a big part of his personality. I think it's a big part of what led him to be weak and addicted and everything is the fact that people don't believe him. He's seeing stuff. He says it's there. He knows it's there, and nobody believes him. I mean, how would you feel? Because, you know, we both talked last episode about how terrifying it would be to be at the bottom of that dumbwaiter and the flashlight goes out and the thing's crawling towards you and obviously attacks you because it rips your clothes up, and yet nobody believes you.
You know, as an adult, I would question whether or not I really saw it. But I guess you have physical proof with the ripped sweater, but who's to say you didn't rip it yourself? And what happened? I mean, we never know what happened. Did, you know, it run away when they found him? Or did he push it away? I mean, they obviously didn't find him with it attached to him. So, I mean, that's all in the mind's eye, I guess. Literally.
Right. Both. I don't think we ever saw, but I think what he was trying to do from a storytelling point of view was kind of set it up that these things aren't just these ephemeral ghostly things that are, you know, that we can push our hands through. They literally can manipulate stuff around them. They can open doors. They can rip clothes. They can push people. They can, you know, so I think he's trying to establish that these ghosts are more permeable. I mean, they're more real than just this, you know, phantom that, you know, goes through the walls kind of thing. Okay, but so where we are is with bowler hat. Sorry, I got just, I tangented off, but we were at bowler hat, which, yes, Luke ends up with it.
Yeah.
And I have in my notes, he doesn't say he likes it. Nellie says he likes it.
Nellie says what?
Which is cool. Nellie says that he likes it. So he puts, like, Dad puts the hat on Luke, and Nellie says he likes it. And Dad goes, how do you know? And that's when she says it's a twin thing.
Right.
So
right.
It's the first kind of thing we have of they share, that kind of bond. And I have in my notes here that this scene ends with a very, you know, literal foreshadowing with Olivia pointing up to all the ropes hanging at the top of the staircase and going, that's an accident waiting to happen. I can see bodies swinging up there.
I know.
Oh, that's right on the nose.
Yeah, that was pretty creepy. Okay, and then we go back to grown Luke, and he is with his friend, I want to say girlfriend, Joey. in a room which looks very much like a cell, almost like a prison cell. And I believe Paige sticks her head in and says, "Your brother called," or is it just another orderly?
It's his counselor.
Yeah, that's Paige.
Yes.
Yeah.
But she basically comes in and says, "Nighty night, lights out," kind of thing. So mm-hmm. they, you know, they're like sharing the cigarette, doing their. And I agree with you. I think they portray this. I don't know if it's a rehab center or a halfway house or whatever. Anyway, they portray it as very prison-like. I think Joey even has a mention about cell blocks or something. You know.
Well, yeah, there's like four of them sleeping in there.
Yeah, it's very sterile. It's like a dormitory kind of feel. But from what I liked in this scene was he mentioned the fourth step. So he's going through the 12-step program. He's on the fourth step, which is the hardest, for I think, for almost any addict, which is this fearless moral inventory. So basically for people who are going through addiction, this step means you have to look back at your entire life, figure out what you've done wrong, and really come to grips with it. Be honest with it. And to the point of going and apologizing to people that you have wronged and hurt. And so they find it really hard to do. And he talks about it's really hard to do for him. And the fact that even if he went back to Steve and apologized, Steve still wouldn't believe even the apology. Which shows how splintered he is from the family.
Right.
The fact that nobody believes him about anything anymore.
Oh, you know, I really never thought about that. But you're right. It's the same way as it was when he was a child and he was seeing ghosts. They didn't believe him then either.
Yeah. Right. And I think you see that throughout this whole episode, especially with Steve. He actually pisses me off in this episode. But... you know, you see that Luke is extraordinarily guilty. He becomes a very empathetic character because he's very guilty for everything he's done as he gets cleaner. But even apologizing or trying to make amends or trying to make up for it won't work because his family doesn't believe. And I also got upset because we talked about it from the, I guess, last episode or second episode. He gets upset that because he blames himself for hurting Nellie because he wasn't at her wedding, and it wasn't his fault. And I got pissed off about that. I felt sorry for little Luke, or big Luke.
Yeah.
Big guy. But because he's blaming himself for that, and that was one thing he shouldn't blame himself for.
Well, he could have been blaming himself for being stoned, too.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Because he looks bad in that scene with Shirley.
Shirley.
I mean, his eyes are like really sunken in. He does look high or definitely effed up. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And he's got the sniffles and all that stuff that he always, I agree.
So he could be kicking himself about that, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. And then next, we have 12:03 on the clock. Luke sits up and guess who's there? Nell. And she just says, go.
And what did you think that meant?
You know, I'm not 100% sure.
I agree with you. I wasn't sure what it meant either. I don't. And even after seeing it, I'm not totally comfortable with what she meant. I don't know what she meant still.
Do you think she meant go to the house?
Possibly. Because it seems like every ghost encounter in the present seems to be pulling or pushing them all towards the house.
Or toward each other.
You know, we don't find out. Or toward each other. Yeah, it could be that, too. But we know, you know, later on in this episode, we see that he kind of misinterprets that. But that was a good scare, I thought. I like the fact that, you know, he did the jump and then Nell is right there. And that was kind of scary.
You know, I'm a little mixed up with the timeline, but would she have been dead by then?
Yes.
She would have had to have been, if that's a ghost. So...
yes. I think she died at 3:03. That's why
12:03,
in the pilot... Well, it's 12:03 in California. It's 3:03
gotcha.
Boston.
Yeah.
Because Dad's clock in, where did you say he's from, in Florida?
He was in Tallahassee.
Yeah, and so his clock's at 3:03.
Or Jacksonville, something like that.
Yeah. But I think that's when she actually died. That's why the whole family wakes up. And you notice when Luke wakes up, he holds his throat. Puts his hand to his neck. And I think that's, one of the subtleties of this episode is what gradually happens to him physically. And I think that's cool. I think this episode to me was much less jump scary and much more this ominous, dread, creepy kind of horror. You know, it was that I feel sorry for these characters. You're pulling me into these characters, but then there's always something lurking.
Okay.
You know.
Now, it just occurred to me, I was trying to piece together the timeline and them finding out and us actually knowing as an audience that she's dead. And then I just realized that, well, she was dead for a little while before Stephen knew, too. Stephen just doesn't find out or see, you know, the ghost until the end of the first episode, which is briefly after his encounter with Luke on the stairwell. You know what I mean? It's a little confusing, but I'm sure the timeline is, I'm sure it makes sense. I'm not going to scrutinize it.
Yeah. I want to think on that. That's a pretty good question, though, actually.
Well, because you got all the stuff that happens with Joey. But there's two different things that happen with Joey. You have Joey in the past when she's at dinner with Stephen and his wife, which we'll get to in a minute. But then you also have the stuff where he's with Joey on the streets because she has slipped from rehab. So you've got a few different little timelines going on here. But anyway, so after...
Hold on. That's it. Yeah. No, I think it's the... This wake up here at 12:03, that's the day before. That's the night, because Joey's gone the next day. And then he goes through that whole night, and that's when, you know, the episode ends. So
Nell is dead by then. So her ghost could potentially be standing in his cell. They just don't
know. Because they haven't found out yet, because Dad hasn't gone to the house yet. And then called everybody.
And no one's been answering.
Which happens the next.
Yeah.
Right. Which happens the next night. And that's why Steve gets the call in the pilot. Mm-hmm. Yes. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is probably when it literally happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of it is slowly everybody finding out.
Yeah.
In their own way.
And I agree with you on the neck rub. I think that's the moment she's dead. When he starts rubbing on his neck, that's when she's dead for sure, because he's feeling it.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll find out till later on, but I wonder if that's the same time as Mom. I don't know if we find that out until near the end, but it would be interesting to see.
The 12:03 thing?
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe the house likes that time.
Yeah.
I'm prone to
that. It's a special
time
for everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. What time do you like? Oh, I like 12:03.
12:03 is good for me.
Okay. So then we go, after the Nell tells him to go, we are back with Luke as a child playing with Nellie. And they are playing with the, I don't know what you call that thing. It's like an intercom, but it looks like a horn.
Yeah, the horn.
Yeah. And they're playing with buttons. They are dropping buttons through the horn, because the tube goes from upstairs all the way down to, I believe, the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And as a button comes down, something says, Clara.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, did I hear that right? Clara, got anything to say about that?
And then what I thought was two points that showed the resiliency of children. One is It's right beside the dumbwaiter, too. And it seems like if I was Luke, I would not want to go anywhere near that damn thing.
Hell no.
But he's standing right beside it by himself in the kitchen. But anyway, so that was one. And then the other one was Nellie comes down, the last button comes through, they hear Claire. He goes up by himself to the bedroom, which is where he just heard the ghostly voice come from. And I'm going, that says a lot about a kid that he's willing to go back up there and do that.
Well, it is daylight. So
true. So there's that. Yes.
But when he goes back up and he goes to say something into the horn, the brass horn, you see the reflection of a very scary face.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who, if it's not Clara, it's probably who was calling for Clara on the horn.
Right. And he goes
and he
jumping
ass
off the bed. Yes.
He's out. Choo. See ya.
Well, and then I like it because it does the first, his kind of visual transitions that he likes to use. It's the first one in this episode because young Luke, jumps down to the bottom of the stairs. And when he lands, it's big Luke landing off the bunk bed.
Yeah, but right before that, did you notice there was a ghost in the room to the right again?
No, I did not. Where?
Yeah, when he's running down the steps, there's one standing over in the room off the side of the stairwell again.
Oh, I missed that one.
Yeah.
Good catch.
Yeah.
I did. I missed that one.
But like you said, he jumps to the bottom of the steps. And then we're in a scene where grown Luke finds a note. I've got a slash therapy here, and then Joey's gone, and Luke leaves angry.
Yeah. He's back in the... Well, he's got the... You know, he gets the note. We don't know what it says.
Not yet.
But then he has to go to his therapy session, and... Paige, I mean, I know that a lot of these counselors and everything else have to be really tough and really strong because addicts will lie to them. Addicts will, you know, but she just seems totally insensitive about it. So much so that Luke gets up and leaves.
Yeah.
And just says, I'm getting some air, but really he has an agenda. He's going to go, you know, he's doing the Luke thing. I'm going to protect my friend kind of thing. And he goes to try to save her, I guess, try to find her.
Right. There's a series of cuts where he's back in his room. I have parentheses cell. And then later, Paige enters, and he's gone, and she finds the note, and the note says, don't follow me.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably written by Joey.
Right.
Yeah.
And he even tries to... You know, while he's looking for her, he tries to call Nell because he's still got her in the back of his mind and he's thinking about her and everything. So he tries to call her, but he leaves a voicemail.
Well,
because
she's dead.
She's not answering her phone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Well, but he doesn't know that part.
I know, but we do because we've established the timeline.
Thank you for calling. I'm dead. Just leave a message. You know.
I will get back with you in the afterlife.
In the afterlife.
Yeah.
See you soon. But I have a note here that says in all these cuts, because it's him on the streets, you know, we're seeing a lot more of probably the life he left to go into rehab kind of thing, and how kind of paranoia you get out there on the streets or whatever. But he sees the across the playground in the daylight, he sees a really tall figure with a bowler hat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you don't know who that is, but you know it's not good.
Right. I refer to that area as Skid Row. Because
okay, good.
Since we Seymour did a show called Little Shop of Horrors twice, it just looks like Skid Row to me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's portrayed that way. It's basically that cliche. And I don't want to say cliche because I think it's... it's real. It happens in lots of cities everywhere. But this, it's a very rundown side of town. There's lots of homeless around. There's lots of
fires,
nefarious activities.
Yeah,
dealers, fires and trash cans, dealers. Shopping carts.
I was gonna say, I wrote down that he's on the payphone. A message for Nell, and I've gotten quotes, had a moment. He must have said, I had a moment.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. He says that line about, I had one of those moments.
Right, right.
Or I had another moment or whatever. And evidently, it's like the title, it's a twin thing. Right. But I think he's referring to the fact of either a memory came back, or he's referring to, he had a moment feeling something for her. Mm-hmm. Like she feels for him. I think that's the moment, the moments they're talking about, is those when I know you're cold because I'm cold. I know you're happy because I'm happy.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
And he grabs his neck again there, too.
Yes.
Or rubs his neck, yeah.
Yeah. So. Rubs his neck. He's still kind of chilling. We're getting the first signs that he's cold, uh-huh. even though it's during the day, and he's got a jacket on and everything.
Uh-huh.
And then he does one of his, Flanagan does another one of his great cuts, because he gets startled by a barking dog, and suddenly it cuts to little Luke, and we hear a barking dog.
Exactly. And remember, they were talking about in an episode earlier that the kids hear the dogs barking, and that guy says, there are no dogs.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The caretaker guy says,
Mr. Dudley,
there's no dogs here. Yeah.
And the transition is to Luke, young again and in bed, and he hears a faint tapping.
Mm-hmm. A little thumping.
Yeah, coming down the hallway. He opens the door, and he looks to the left, and he sees a very tall ghost. So what does he do? He closes the door very quietly, and he gets under the bed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and three or four things there that I love. Did you like this ghost design? I thought that was a creepy character. Because he's tall. He's in a long coat that goes almost to his ankles. Very thin. Almost that kind of Tim Burton-y skeletal kind of thing. And he's got a cane. But he also floats off the ground, which I thought was creepy.
Mm-hmm. It's very reminiscent of something, and I meant to research it, and I forgot to, so I'm kind of trying to do it right now. But I'll get to that later.
No, you can do that, because the other thing that got me, keep looking while I'm jabbering.
Okay, sure.
But the obviously this spirit that, or this ghost, this creature, he doesn't know what it is, but Luke can actually see it, and he's obviously searching for something in the hallway. He's going down the hallway. He turns. He comes back. He goes into a door, one of the other bedrooms, probably Theo's, I guess, or one of the girls. And while he's in that bedroom, Luke closes the door and hides in the bed. And you get the impression that he knows he's going to come looking. Doesn't know what for, doesn't know why he's looking. He just knows he's looking. And I also have in my notes that this is one of my favorite scenes in this episode. And I like it because it's with that moving camera work. The camera starts on Luke and basically goes from Luke to the door, pans back, and we see Luke again, pans back as Luke goes to the door. I mean, it follows him kind of thing. But it starts with this repetitive shot that he keeps using throughout this whole series of somebody lying on their side in bed. And they're framed in a way that we don't know what's behind. We're afraid something's going to reach out behind him, something's going to be behind him, somebody's going to pull the sheets off of, something. But he keeps using this imaging of, you may be nestled in your bed, but you're not safe, kind of thing. He hides under the bed, and we get that great suspense thing that we see in, I'm going to save it. I'm going to write it down right now and use it as a key later.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. I had it for a key, and I found out what it was I was looking for. I'll mention it later.
Oh, okay, so it's a key.
Yeah, kind of. It's not really a key to a movie, but yeah.
Okay.
It's a key to like an icon.
Oh, it can be. Yeah.
Yeah.
It can be iconic for me. Mm-hmm. I agree with it. Did you like the whole end of this scene where we think he's going to get away and suddenly he exhales and the thing stops and then turns and comes back?
Yeah. I love when you see the shadow of him picking up the hat.
Yes. And we realize that's what he's come to get. Luke has his hat.
Right.
So evidently this is the character who that hat, or you know, the ghost is whoever owned that hat before Niles. And, but we also get even more information because he even reaches under the bed, literally pulls the bedspread up and puts his hat, his head, you know, I mean, Luke's in and sees Luke.
Yeah.
And that's when Luke screams. And then we cut to taxi break. So we get another audio.
And
cut,
what about like that high-pitched scream? I mean, I don't even
think... my gosh.
It's like two episodes in a row we've seen him screaming. Or mm-hmm. heard him screaming. Yeah.
And that really high pitch, too, which mm-hmm. is, you know, which puts you on edge. It's mm-hmm. creepy.
Okay, I've got Luke sighs, man turns, hand, face, scream.
Uh-huh.
Which is pretty, you know, pretty terrifying. After that, yeah, like you said, Luke's back on the street.
And I'll throw something at you. It got me because I was wondering, okay, so the dumbwaiter scene, basically, mom and dad come down, they rescue him, pull him out. Let's go over here. Everything's okay. The bent neck lady, we never know what happens. You know, I mean, other than when Nellie starts screaming, people come to help her. So I guess bent neck lady goes away. So are we assuming that's what happened here? I mean, why, you know, what prevented the guy from reaching under there and snatching Luke up or whatever? We assume mommy and daddy came running, or Nell?
Yeah, running. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's poetic license. It's a great cut when somebody screams. You know, scream, cut, next scene. You know?
Yeah, next scene. Good transition. Did well, like, there.
What happened? Well, we don't have to worry about it because we cut.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. You have to figure those things out in other mediums, but not always in television, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
Yeah, my guess is that mom and dad came running and the ghost vanished. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, but I mean, mom and dad see ghosts too, so who knows?
Yeah, true.
Maybe
true.
He said.
Well, we don't know that Hugh has seen any yet.
You know what he said?
Olivia might have.
The ghost actually said, "Do you have the time?" And Luke said, 1203.
1203.
Anyway. So like you said, we cut to brakes or something on the street. Luke sees...
Yeah, taxi cab. Yeah.
Yeah. Luke sees Joey speaking with what is apparently a drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
He talks with her, tries to call Paige, who will not let them come back because they broke the rules.
Yeah, my notes say, finds Joey, but that bitch Paige won't let him come back.
Right. You know the rules. What was that old movie?
Yeah, you brought this on yourself, she even says. I just hate that for them. And I know they have to keep those rules. And again, they have to be strong and everything else. It just... sucks because you're seeing somebody who's really trying and can't get a break.
Right. Luke, I've got a note that Luke rubs his neck again in this scene, and he sees the tall mm-hmm. man again at the very end of it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And he also starts getting colder. He even mentions he's cold.
Right. Then we have sort of a transition. It's not back to a child. It's just him and Joey walking. And he tells Joey that mm-hmm. she reminds him of Nell.
Yeah.
Why do you think he says that?
I think it's true. I think it for two or three things. I think from a storyteller, like writer Mike Flanagan point of view, They want to show that this isn't a physical relationship. She's not really literally his girlfriend. She is somebody he cares a great deal about. I think that's what he's trying to say. And he has to literally say that, say you're my sister, not my hottie addict girlfriend or whatever. But also I think he genuinely feels that. He feels a connection to her because he even says it. He says, because you believe me. Yeah. And no one else in my entire family has ever believed me except Nell. And I think she fills that void that Nell had.
Because Nell always believed
was him. Too. Yeah, and she was always there. It was a twin thing, blah, blah, blah. But now she's married on her own life, doing her thing, and he's like alone. And, you know, reaching out for somebody that will be, you know, will care about him and believe him.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's the answer right there. She reminds him of Nell because she believes in him and no one else does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think, again, as you've said, what makes this series work, I mean, if you had watched this scene, you would not think this series was a horror story. Because this scene is just great character work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what, you know, like you said, I was kind of hooked at the, you know, you said you were hooked at the beginning because you knew it would be scary, but then what really hooked you were the characters. And I think that's been said repeatedly about this series is what Flanagan has done is created this realistic family, these realistic characters, they're well portrayed, and they, you know, it's just compelling to watch. We start getting really invested in these characters. Yeah, because, I mean, this whole scene, this whole, I mean, them walking, going up to Steve's house and then him finding out Steve's not there, but then this whole flashback of months ago, or I guess 2 months ago or whatever, when he actually brought Joey to the house and Steve and his wife, you know, and they all had dinner.
It was when he had gotten his 30-day chip.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
They were like celebrating.
And again, a great dinner scene, cool character with all of them. Joey really has her stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
Except, yeah, and we're kind of endeared to her. We like her. And obviously she likes Luke and they have a, you know, relationship. They've helped each other and that works. The wife hardly says, as a matter of fact, I don't even think she says anything this entire scene. She just kind of looks around reproachfully. But Steve is such a dick in this scene.
Why do you think he is such a dick? Because he really pisses me off in this scene.
I know. This scene and the next one especially. Well, it's because I don't know if it's we're really trying to hammer home the fact that he is in denial. He denies everything. He doesn't believe anybody about anything. Or if he's just felt so burned. I mean, I think in an earlier scene in this episode, I think in that, fourth step scene with Joey, I think Luke says something about, I've taken so much money from Steve or whatever. But still, I mean, we all know about siblings and the trouble that you can have with siblings and everything else, but he just acts like a total dick in these two scenes. And he insults Joey, and he just acts like a jerk. Even though in the kitchen scene, we see Joey and the wife outside, and obviously they're laughing and getting along, and everything mm-hmm. seems to be fine.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something.
I mean, why do you? What do you think? Why do you think he's such a dick?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's because we like Luke so much, and we want to see Luke succeed. Why doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't you? And I love the Capper line. You know, Luke has, I can't remember it. I didn't write it down. But, you know, Luke basically saying, you know, I came here to celebrate my 30 days. And thanks for making me feel like shit again, Steve, like you always do.
Yeah.
You know, and he kind of, you know, walks out. And I'm just going, yeah, thanks, Steve.
Oh, you know what? I've got another thought. I've got another thought that's pretty valid, actually.
Yeah.
He's not happy to see Luke happy with this girl because he's not happy with his wife. Because he and Leah broke up two months later.
Yeah, so maybe they're having the fights now. Obviously they are.
Yeah.
But And maybe he's feeling like, don't trust any woman because they'll hurt you.
It could be.
So, yeah, but if that was, yeah, and I think that's a cool layer, but if that was true, I would have liked to have seen dialogue that kind of represented that a little bit more.
Yeah.
So it didn't seem so much like he was literally attacking Steve. It was, I mean, Luke, it was that he was taking out his own BS on Luke.
Yeah, I agree. There should have been some dialogue to that effect, but as an actor, I can see him using that.
Oh, yeah. Yes, easily.
Yeah. Because, I mean, they're broke. I mean, literally, before that scene, it's Lee telling Luke she's not giving him any money, and he asked for Steve's address.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know he's gone because she tells him. And that's...
Well, she even says, I think, something like, no, Steve's not here, and I don't think he'll ever be here again, or he's not coming back, or whatever.
Right.
She says something like that. So, and you can see, again, good acting. You can see it in Luke's face. He wants to say, what? And she says, I don't want to talk about it. And you know he wants to go, well, what's wrong? How can, and instead he goes, I got my own shit to deal with.
You know what I was just thinking is, what? You know how they have referred to the money from the book that he dispersed amongst the family as blood money. Yeah.
Yeah.
What if that's part of the curse, is that, you know, all this shit starts happening because they took that money. And I mean, Shirley didn't take it, but her husband did. And you find that out later. So she took it indirectly, not knowing, of course, but you know, she's a victim as a result. I mean, I don't think that's, I'm not buying into that. I just think it's an interesting theory, though.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blood money.
Yeah.
Don't take it.
That reminds me.
It's cursed.
Okay, I'll bring it up later, but that reminds me of something. Yeah. It's cursed.
Yeah. It's cursed. Okay. So, I've got Steve and Luke do dishes. Steve's a jerk. Good people will burn you. Is one of Steve's lines. And the first thing that popped into my head was his dad. I think he feels maybe burned by the father.
Well, I got that. Yeah, I got two things off that. I got dad, that one. Good people burn you, you know, like dad did. And subliminally, and like you burn me, even though you say you're a good guy, Luke, blah,
right,
blah, blah.
Right.
But I also got, okay, that's kind of alliteration back to the story, the soldier story of people don't know what it's like when people burn, kind of thing. I mean, that may be a stretch, but that I kind of got that out of it too. That it kind of ties back in a little bit to burning, kind of thing. But now to your point, maybe he's referring to his wife.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
Maybe he's referring to Lee in that scene.
Steve is just not having a good day.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't like anybody.
My damn brother.
Yeah,
my damn brother shows up and he's happy. Yeah. I hate it when my brother's happy.
Fuck him. Fuck his girlfriend. Fuck his wife. Fuck my life. I don't know. He's just got something going on, and it's obvious. It's quite obvious.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So Luke kicks the kitchen door, and we transition to him kicking in Steve's apartment door.
Yes. Yeah, another one of those visuals.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
Mm-hmm. And he, you know, rummages through the drawers. He steals some stuff. And then we come to that scene from the first episode where they meet on the staircase, except this time it's from Luke's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that shit. I think I said before, I eat that stuff like candy. That's just awesome storytelling. where you can just jump from character to character in the same scene.
And you get so much of the counter POV, which I really like. I like the fact that we had this in our mind. We had already pegged Luke. We knew Luke just because we saw it from Steve's angle. And ripping off your, you know, you even said it. He's ripping off my, you know, you're ripping off my stuff. How'd you let him steal my stuff?
Right.
And we, but now we see it from a totally different angle and see that Luke isn't even doing this for himself. He's doing this for Joey, and it's all this selfless kind of act, not selfish. And when he says the line, "This isn't what you think, Steve," it's totally different interpretation.
Yeah.
When we see it from his point of view.
Because we know what has happened from the other side.
Yeah. And his inflection is this, "I know you're not going to believe me, but this really isn't what you think." I mean, you can see this defeat. You can hear this defeatist kind of mental attitude in the way he inflects that line. You know, it's why am I even going to try to explain it to you? Because you won't believe me, just like you always do. So, yeah, it was really good. I like that seeing it from a different perspective. And I think, is this the first time in the series we get something from a different perspective? Well, no, because if we count, like in last week's episode with Theo, there was that one scene that suddenly cut to her point of view when Nellie's body arrived. And when she had the whole thing about, I can't do this, and she left Shirley and drove away. So I think that may have been the first one. But he does that really well in this, giving us these moments, and then we see him from a different person's point of view and totally have different interp.
Right.
So, cool work. Cool writing again.
Yeah, it's very layered, especially when you're doing it in different episodes. They did it on Castle Rock too. They did it on Castle Rock really well too.
They did.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Now we are back with Joey, and he has $200. She is thrilled. They're walking. Luke is very cold now. I wrote that he is hurting. And I also wrote that we know Nell is dead, but he doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah, like shivering almost.
Joey says she has to pee. She kisses him. And while she's kissing him, obviously picks his pocket and takes the money and heads to whatever the quote bathroom is. Some alley.
Yeah. The attic's bathroom. What she called a junkie bathroom, is what she called them, I think.
Yeah. And he soon realizes the money's gone. He screams Joey, and he sees the tall man again with the hat.
Yeah. And I liked his acting here because, you know, when the kiss happened, he was like really hesitant, almost literally flinched, pulled back when she started to kiss him. And then after she kissed him, it was like his whole face was like, you could tell it wasn't a, oh, thank God you finally did that. I've been in love with you all these months. It was like, why the hell did you do that?
It was confusion.
And it was almost like a brother-sister kind of thing, you know? You got that kind of, well, that was weird, wasn't it? And, okay, and I got to ask, did you know what was happening when she did that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I did, too. Yeah. I think all the subtlety of the way it was shot and everything else, I think he telegraphed that really well to us as an audience. It was like, dude, don't, she's ripping you off. She's ripping you off.
Yeah.
Which I think just endears us to Luke even more. You know, poor Luke keeps getting screwed as a little kid and as an adult.
Well, and if he's confused by the kiss, that means she's misinterpreting him as well because she thinks he wants the kiss.
Oh, yeah. It'll distract him enough.
Right.
Kind of thing.
And that means that she doesn't know him or doesn't care about him anyway. And that's why she's up to something.
Yeah.
Bitch.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. I want to ask you a question about that.
I guess I wrote briefly there was a scene at Skid Row with the tall man, but I thought that was the end of this scene because the next thing I have is Luke again at his 90-day chip speech.
Yeah, we go back to the scene like from the beginning where he's telling his whole, starting to tell his story, except this time we hear a little bit more. We hear the story.
Right. And as he's telling the story, we're seeing flashbacks of him, or not flashbacks, but I guess, I don't know if they're flashbacks or flash forwards.
They flash forward because it's him getting ripped off.
Right. He's getting like beat up by some thugs on the street. And later we see him walking. He doesn't even have shoes. They took his shoes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking, okay, first of all, you five asshole or whatever. Well, why would you beat up on a guy who obviously looks like another junkie? You know, I mean, he's shivering. He's doesn't look well. Da, da, da. Why would you beat? And then I thought, oh yeah, you're taking his coat and his shoes. Okay. Cause you know, he doesn't have any money, but.
I don't have much about his speech, but I did note that he mentions his mother's suicide.
Yeah, I think, because I watched that twice in this rewatch, that scene, just to, one was just looking at it and watching him get beat up and all that, but the other was just to listen to what he told. And he basically told the story of he didn't really realize his mother was had committed suicide and died when it happened and when he had to go live with his aunt. And everything, because he kept wanting his mom to come back. And he tells that great story of, I used to think that any headlights that came up to the house at night were her driving up. It was mom coming back, coming to get me. And you feel even more sad about him. I mean, you just want to say, dude, I'm so sorry. And I wrote down, he has a great line where he says, but none of the headlights ever were. And he says, the tail lights were the worst. Red eyes in the dark, just taking hope with them.
Wow.
And I thought that was so poetically written.
Yeah.
And says so much to his character, the fact that he keeps getting his hopes up and they keep going away. And that's probably contributed to that whole addict life, too.
Yeah.
Of, you know, he... Every time he takes a step forward, he takes three back, kind of thing. I find my friend Joey and she dicks me and steals my money and goes away or whatever. You know, mom's never coming back, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And again, I think subliminally it reinforces this whole thing that we see. And I think that might be cool on the third watch to see is how many times do these kids reference their mother?
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, Steve says, it's a disease that mom had. You know, Shirley mentions the fact that dad never told us about mom. You know, I think there's all these references to mom. And to Luke's, it was, you're never coming to save me. You're never coming to get me.
The headlights is a sort of a foreshadow, too, because there's about to be headlights.
Yes.
Too.
I had not thought of that, but that is very true.
Yeah.
That makes total sense now. Yeah. But then to your point, yeah, he sees his bowler guy again.
Yeah, he sees the guy again. I mean, he sees the guys multiple times, but he sees the tall man again, and then you have the applause of the end of his speech. And then he's back on the phone, speaking with Paige, telling her he didn't fuck up and that he is very cold. He's begging her basically, and she is with someone, but we don't see who it is.
Right.
I've got counting. Oh, it's him counting.
Yeah, he counts to seven. He's doing the seven count.
Yeah.
He's walking and pacing and doing the seven count.
Which is...
Because... but we don't know why yet, really.
Right.
We know that he's counting to seven, but we don't know why.
Right.
And I also have another line from his speech, which is... And I've actually mentioned this to counselors and other people, but he says, any addict alone, and everybody repeats, is in bad company. Which is obviously some kind of line that they use in therapy, in the 12 step.
I'm sure.
But yeah, I loved the scene, the way they shot and did that scene with him trying, literally begging Paige, saying, I'll sleep on the floor. I don't care. I just need a place. I'm freezing. And he even mentions he's hurting now. His arms are stiff, I think, you know, in that scene or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And she is she's obviously looking at somebody we don't know who until the end of that scene, and we realize it's Steve.
Yeah.
And she says, we'll come and get you. But she doesn't tell him about Steve. She just says, we'll come and get you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then we cut to little Luke in bed. And Nell is crying about the BetNet lady. So Luke gets in bed with her and tells her that she needs 7 buttons. And that they represent the family members. I wrote very OCD. It has to be 7. It keeps you safe.
Yes. It keeps you safe. I love that line. It keeps you safe.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, some forms of OCD is counting. People counting. That's why that went.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, I think that's why Sheldon knocks 3 times kind of thing. I think that's that was a great scene, too. I liked it. And obviously, it's another night. It's not the night from the premiere when she saw BetNet Lady and Steve came in and Dad came in and all that. So obviously, this is another time she's seeing BetNet Lady. So God knows how many times she saw her as a little girl.
Mm-hmm. Then we have Luke basically pacing on the street and counting 7.
Mm-hmm.
And the tall man is behind him. And following him.
Yes.
And when he stops, the good tall man stops. Scene. Yeah, it's pretty creepy. He continues counting 7. And at one point, he finally stops because he knows the tall man is right behind him. And he turns, and it's not the tall man. It's his mother.
Mm-hmm.
And her eyes are like headlights. Bright lights.
Yes.
Which is, again, foreshadowing from the previous speech.
Yep.
And then it turns out that they're not her eyes at all. They're the lights from the car, and it's Paige and Steven pulling up to the curb to get him.
Yes. Yeah. Really good transition. I loved the way that whole scene played out. I like the terror part of him walking and counting to 7, and we see the guy in the background. And when he moves, the bowler man moves or the tall man moves. But then that third time, he stops, and then the bowler man starts moving towards him and gets right behind him. And you just go, oh, no, 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 no. It was good. I liked that. But then, yeah, turning around, and it's mom. And she says something, right? She says, like, baby or honey or come home or something. Anyway, she says something to him before her eyes go all red or white. Come home or something like that.
I didn't write
and
it down.
And then we realize that, yeah.
So I'm not really sure.
But then we realize that it's Steve and Paige. And just, again, the emotion of that scene is so good. The look on Luke's face when he sees it's Steve and he's almost crying and they hug each other.
Yeah. And he mumbles he couldn't help it. He's so cold. He's hurt. He's numb.
Yeah, yeah.
And then.
Well, and the line, again, it's that sometimes we read too much into it, I guess, because you and I read too much into it sometimes. Just because we like to do that. But I also think it was intentional. But he's hugging Steve and he says, I'm sorry I couldn't help her. And I think Luke is talking about Joey, or is he? And Steve is interpreting that as
now.
Yeah,
I could see that
because he hasn't told him yet,
right? However, I think that you're talking about Steve being in denial, but it could potentially be Luke being in denial, because I would think Luke probably knows, because it's a twin thing.
Yeah, I agree. But, well, then again, I think he's been so focused on Joey that he didn't see all the signs and see it all together until Steve tells him. It's kind of the way I took it.
Which is
and then once Steve tells him, he realizes all the stiffness, all the neck hurt, all the cold was him feeling Nellie.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just creepy and sad all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And, well, Steve tells him the very next scene, or the very next shot, really. He says, come with me, Nell's dead. And Luke says, how? Steve says, suicide. Luke rubs his neck and says, no, it wasn't.
Yeah.
And then that's the end. Yeah. And you're like, wow.
I loved it. Again, his hooks at the end of each episode are so good. But this one was probably one of my favorites. And he also said, I have a note, he said Stevie. He didn't say Steve. He said Stevie, like, very familial.
He's a little kid, you know, again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I keep calling him Steve. And I think his name is Steven, but...
Yeah, but most people call him Steve.
Okay, because that's all I've been writing down because it's shorter. But, yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's how he ended the episode, which was really good. I think it's a great ending to that.
Yeah.
So what would you rank this episode? What do you think it was overall? You liked it? It was good?
I like all of them. But, you know, we were talking last week about how you thought last week's was probably the weakest in the series, the third episode.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And I'm leaning more toward this one, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think I like last week's episode better. But it could be because I just like Theo.
Could be, yeah.
And I really like that dumbwaiter scene, too. Yeah, I liked it better than the ghost in the room with the hat.
Yes. Well, I think this one we probably get the least about the house. You know, this is much more of Steve's story than it is about the house. Other than
Lou, you mean.
Bowler guy and... one hint at the spiral staircase, we don't get anything about the house in this.
No, it's primarily Luke on the street.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that as far as moving that story forward, it doesn't really do that very well.
Mm-hmm.
Cool, good point.
Yeah, I kept expecting Ken Howard to come up with a basketball and start dribbling. That's an old reference for you folks out there. Look it up.
There you go. Well, Kate, which is a great transition to keys. So what keys did you get from this one?
I didn't get a lot of keys. And I have a feeling now that may be why it's my least favorite episode. Because it wasn't as filled with horror references or ghostly references. One of the things I wanted to say that I looked up a moment ago was I kept saying, where have I seen that man in the trench coat and the hat and the cane silhouette? I said, that is a very prominent icon or whatever. And I realized, there is a painting, I can't remember who did it, of a man with a bowler hat and an apple in front of his face. Do you know?
Yeah.
But what I'm
it was used actually, it's what the Beatles used for their album. I mean, for their studio.
The Green Apple.
That's where Green Apple came from.
Yeah. However, the one I'm thinking of is on the back of Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here album. And it's of a man in a bowler hat holding an album. And he has no face or hands. He's like invisible.
Oh.
It's just the suit and the hat. And the gloves.
So true.
And I was like, that's where I'm remembering this from. You know, is he a Pink Floyd fan or what? I was thinking it was either Pink Floyd or Fleetwood Mac. I couldn't remember. And then I finally just Googled it while we were talking. And it's Pink Floyd.
Uh-huh.
So.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
And that's really good. To me.
It's the back of the album, not the front of the album.
To me, he also reminded, a key I had was he reminded me a lot of Slender Man. This whole, the whole guy that's from Creepypasta. That's the, you know, the really tall, thin, you know, almost like Jack Skellington thin. Because I think there have been images of him in a tie and a coat and a hat, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, I kind of got that one from it a little bit, but I hadn't thought of the Pink Floyd one. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Another key I had from early on was the whole feel of this, the coloring, the design of this whole therapy room and the barracks, or sorry, the the dorm room or whatever, reminded me of Cuckoo's Nest. I just got a lot of Cuckoo's Nest of sitting around and confessing, you know, I expected to, you know, to hear somebody say, play the game, play the game.
You know. I want my cigarettes, my cigarettes.
I want.
Yeah. I don't want his. I want mine.
I want my cigarettes. But yeah, that was the key I wrote down. Let me see.
I've got one that is along the same lines you were saying as far as the setting. The fact that, and I was making jokes about The White Shadow, that television show earlier, because it's Skid Row, you know. All the scenes where they're like walking around with, you know, trash cans on fire and derelicts standing around and dealers and hobos or whatever, remind me a lot of Clive Barker's stories, Hellraiser and Candyman in particular, you know, because Candyman was set in Cabrini Green, which is a real bad neighborhood. And then there's a scene
in Chicago. Yeah.
Yes. And there's a scene at the end of Hellraiser where there's a derelict that, you know, turns into some kind of weird dragon or something. But anyway, they're all standing around a bonfire and a junky part of the city. I don't know. All of that just, for some reason, it gave me like a Barker-esque flair.
Yeah, I could see that whole urban nightmare, urban madness kind of feel. Yeah.
Right.
I could see that.
Yeah. And that's kind of a setting thing, too. But we're reaching. You realize that.
Well, yeah, it's just what impressions we're getting now. It's and it's hard for us because, you know, normally in this podcast, we're picking things that not only have been influenced by things, but also have influenced stuff since. It's kind of hard to do that with this show since it's so current.
Correct.
So we don't know who's going to steal from all of his ideas. No, be inspired by or, you know, whatever the ideas from this series and take them somewhere else.
Right.
But so, yeah, we are kind of reaching and play. Well, like for me, one of mine's is when any time that young Luke wears the bowler hat, he reminds me of that kid in Peter Pan, even though his hat is a top hat.
Oh, yeah.
But he reminds me of the little kid in Peter Pan,
Jonathan,
with the glasses.
Isn't his name Jonathan? Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I think so, or something like that. But yeah, that's who he reminds me of. So that's one of the keys I wrote down.
Yeah.
What was the other one? Oh, you gave me one while we were talking.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm under the bed, I'm safe, I'm great, and then suddenly, no, I'm not, I get jerked from under the bed, reminding me of Taken, the Liam Neeson movie, you know, with his daughter, and she's on the phone to him and everything, and you think the guy has gone away, but suddenly he comes back and grabs her from under the bed.
Oh.
Sort of thing. It reminded me of that. You know, you think you're safe, but then you exhale once and the bastard comes
back. Yeah. I have seen that movie, but it has been a long time. I didn't remember that at all.
Yeah, that one. Well, and there have been others too. You know, this whole hide under the bed, but you're not really safe.
Yeah.
The reverse of that is the one from Poltergeist, which always got everybody.
That just popped into my head when you said that. That's funny.
Yeah. You know, you look under the bed, it's not there. You sit up and suddenly it grabs
you. Behind you. So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you gave me another. Okay, you do one, then I'll do another one.
Well, this is not really a key, but I had to bring it up because it just cracked me up. Because obviously Flanagan is a Stephen King fan. He's directed at least two, maybe three King properties, or is attached to maybe three. So he knows Stephen King, and he knows about Stephen King. And I loved that when they were sitting around eating dinner, Joey asked Stephen where he gets his ideas. That just cracked me up, because that is like Stephen King's most hated question, and he has been bitching about that question for decades.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Mine you gave me, which was, you know, the curse and the blood money and everything else, was Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah,
that's the whole curse of the original one.
It's the curse of the Black Pearl.
Cool. But that's really all the ones I mean I didn't get that many from this, just because I think he was doing some really cool original kind of stuff in this, and he was more focused on the you know, the family dynamic and the story rather than horror tropes.
Yeah.
And telling a scary story.
Yeah. And coming, I mean, from a writer's perspective, you know, he had to tell each of their connection. In these episodes, he's telling their connections somewhat to Nell. And with Luke, mm-hmm. he had to go deeper because of the twin thing. So mm-hmm. I think that's why it's a little more personal, a little more in the present, and a little more less, or a little less horror oriented and more brother sister oriented.
Yeah. And I think if we go along with the belief that, you know, each of these family members in descending order is stages of grief, then that means Luke is a depression. And in order to be, you know, to feel that depression, you got to kind of see it from his eyes.
Yeah.
You got to kind of be in that frame of mind to understand the depression angle of it. And again, going back to what we talked about earlier, you know, the whole nobody believes me, no matter what I do. You know, so it's that defeatist, depressive kind of feel.
Right.
So, yeah. I'm not with you. I still kind of hold to my Theo's was the weakest episode. But again, I think it's for our different reasons. I like Luke a lot. He's a very sympathetic character to me.
Yeah.
And so naturally this episode would elevate a little bit more than Theo's. But I do think the arc of the season is going along really well, and he's telling this story. He's really compelling us to care about these people, but then keeping the mystery there. You know, what happened at the house? What happened with Mom? What happened with Nelly? You know, have we only had one scene at all with Dad in the present, so
right.
to speak? You know?
Yeah, and it may just be the fact that I was looking for more scares, and really there weren't that many, and the one that was there was not as striking to me as the one that was in the last episode down in the cellar.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think this had the scare factor of the other episodes in the show. It had the creep factor, and you know, even down to the bowler or the tall man, you know, creeping up on him kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But it didn't have the jump scares or the real, there's a monster creature. You know,
oh, and it's kind of like the monkey on your back thing. I didn't even think about that.
Oh, yeah?
Because
yeah.
he was always behind haunted. Him. And so yeah. was the addiction. Well, I mean, you know, that phrase.
That whole
monkey
metaphor.
On your back. Yeah.
yeah.
Interesting. Yep. That's another thing.
That's a good one. I like that a lot. Hmm. He should have had a monkey in a bowler. And that would have worked.
And then it would have been a Pixies album cover.
I'm gonna have to look up the Floyd cover now, because I did not get that one at all. That's cool.
Yeah, I can send it to you if you want. I just Googled it. I've got a picture of it on my screen right now. But so who's next week? Shirley?
No, next week is Nell. Next week is Nellie, the last child.
Okay.
Because they've each done in descending order. So we've gone from, you know, we started with Steve, then Shirley, then Theo, now Luke, and then Nelly.
Okay.
And I don't know if they ever say, that might be something for us to listen for in the coming episodes. Do they ever say who's the oldest by how long, you know, between Luke and Nelly?
Oh.
I don't know.
I don't know that they have.
Well, obviously, Nelly's the youngest. Just because, I mean, she's portrayed the youngest all the way through it. The most childlike, even as an adult, she's more childlike.
Oh, so they've done, I didn't know they were doing this in age. So it was Stephen,
yeah.
Shirley, Theo, Luke, then Nell. Okay, gotcha.
Yep.
Wow,
yep.
I had no idea.
And those are the five stages. So next week, we'll do Nellie's episode, and she will be accepted.
Wow. And then we'll go to episode six when all the shit hits the fan.
Boy, will we. We want, that'll be a 3 hour. Yeah. No.
That's a great one.
Cool.
Yeah. Well,
excellent.
It's been a
pleasure. Again, Yeah, and again, this is all, I think, you know, both of us have such high praise for Flanagan throughout all this. It's his baby, and I think he's been doing brilliant with it.
Yeah. Yeah, too bad Shirley Jackson's not around. I'd like to see what she thinks.
Very true. Yeah. I would, too. I would be very excited to know what she would think of this show.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's going to do it for this episode.
Thank you guys for listening.
Yeah, be sure and let us know your comments. And let us know if you picked up anything we may have not seen. We're always curious to know. Like us on Facebook.
How rare could that be?
What's that?
I said, how rare could that be?
Right, right. Yeah, like I didn't even pick up on the age thing.